Welcome all, I'm Stephen Brook and you're listening to Media Talk. Coming up this week, Google sends a shockwave through the internet as it threatens to pull out of China. We find out what this means for censorship, Chinese blogging and freedom of information. Also in the podcast.
Morning, Liz.
Morning.
Morning, Johnny Spools.
Good morning.
Here we are, the new team indeed. It's only going to get worse. Now, they do say break a leg, but not in this weather. Not in this weather. I don't think so.
It's all change at BBC Radio with Evans, Mayo and Bacon starting new gigs, as well as Gabby Logan and Tony Livesey. Stand by for the Media Talk verdict. Plus, is Rod Liddell really about to become editor of The Independent? And
Inky Pinky Punky, father had a donkey. Donkey died, father cried. Inky Pinky Punky.
Harry Hill's in Big Money Talks to join Sky. With Simon Cowell heading to America, is ITV's worst nightmare about to come true? This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Well, there's no Matt Wells this week. He's off skiing, or so he says. No need to hurry back, Matt. But joining me in the pod for the first time this year, I'm delighted to welcome back to the studio Media Guardian columnist Maggie Brown, as well as Kids Co TV Managing Director Paul Robinson. Lovely to see you both. Now, Maggie, before we begin, have you got anything to say about British Telecom?
You mean I was cut off this week?
Apparently so.
Yes, I was. Well, it was actually quite a nice little interlude, but it didn't last long enough, actually. Was it the snow? I have no idea.
Paul, what about you? How are your connections?
I turned my BlackBerry off. Does that count?
Yeah. Well, that's self-inflicted, isn't it?
So. Yeah, and it was painful, too. When I turned it back on again, it vibrated for about 10 minutes.
Good. Yes. Well, look, we'll come to the changes at Radio 2 and 5 Live a little later, but we're going to start this week with the big news on the internet.
Media Talk from Guardian.co.uk.
Google has thrown down the gauntlet to China by declaring it's no longer willing to censor search results on its Chinese servers. The internet giant said that the decision followed a spate of cyber attacks. One was on the Chinese human rights activists that use Gmail, whilst another was aimed at stealing some of Google's top secret source codes. Kevin Anderson is The Guardian's digital research editor, and I spoke to him earlier in our newsroom and began by asking who he thought would emerge victorious from this struggle.
I cannot see China just backing down on this. China has, by some reports, 25,000 police who are dedicated to monitoring the internet. When you go into internet cafes in China, there's often a party minder just to make sure that the people are engaging in appropriate behavior online. They have one of the most developed net monitoring censorship systems of infrastructure in the world. They're not just going to sort of say, tomorrow we're going to turn off the Great Firewall, which is kind of the loose term that we all use for this stuff. They've got a huge investment. And, you know, China's a big, fractious country. They've got, you know, Tibet. They've got Uyghurs in Western China. So there are lots of political issues that they need to keep a lid on. So I don't see China just rolling over on this. That's not what they do.
And practically, what can it do to Google, who has said that, A, we're going to stop censoring our websites, and B, we may well depart? How possibly could the Chinese government respond to Google's threats?
For any company to operate an internet business in China, they have to get a license from the Chinese government. And this has been a real contentious issue for Western companies, Microsoft, Yahoo, Cisco, which builds kind of the plumbing of the internet, because basically it signs up to a lot of restrictions, largely on political-based content, that are pretty offensive to most Western democratic sensibilities. And so there's been an economic reason for all of these companies to go in there, but there's been a bit of a backlash that these companies have faced from civil libertarians over, signing away cherished rights and to basically do business.
Well, Google went into China 4 years ago, and that was controversial at the time because it does, after all, have the corporate motto, don't be evil. And many people criticized it at the time for going against that philosophy, yet it seemed to be quite happy to sign up to these conditions.
It didn't sign up to the conditions unconditionally, though, and it's important to point out that Google, unlike some of the other internet companies, actually negotiated a deal where if Google.cn, the Chinese version of Google, blocks a search result, it lets the user know. It doesn't let them know what's been blocked. It just says, "Sorry, this is restricted content," and that was one of the things that they negotiated. They also negotiated some limited access to Google.com. So Google didn't just walk in there and sign over its soul, so to speak, just for filthy lucre. It actually did try to negotiate a deal. And you know, the subtext to this confrontation is obviously there was some negotiation going on. And I think what's interesting is that they've chosen to go publicly with what can only be described as a nuclear option to sort of quit the company or quit the country. So it's partly a negotiating tactic, obviously. I think the other thing, though, is it's really rare for a company to say we were the target of an attack. Most this happens all the time. Happens in, you know, all over the world, not just in China. But it's very rare for a company to go public with that.
Kevin Anderson there. Hope that all made sense. Look, you can read plenty more on this by clicking on to guardian.co.uk/technology, or why not tune into the latest edition of Media Talk USA with resident Googleologist Jeff Jarvis. Anyway, shall we see what's on the radio?
The Five Live daytime team going with a new 10-12, 2 o'clock formation. And the referee blows his whistle, and with that signals the next 6 hours underway.
A new year and a new look to the Five Live daytime lineup.
Weekdays from 10.
And straight away it goes to Victoria Derbyshire. Beautiful control. Passes it to Gabby Logan.
Weekdays 12 till 2.
Logan gathers it and now gives it to Richard Bacon.
Monday to Thursday, 2 till 4.
Bacon takes it on the turn and fires it in. Absolutely brilliant. News, sport and entertainment all in there. Lovely, skillful chat.
The new daytime lineup.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
Well, it's unquestionably been the most important 7 days in British radio this year. But just 2 weeks into 2010, that's admittedly not saying much. As you just heard in that dreadful promo, 5 Live launched its new daytime lineup, while over on Radio 2, Chris Evans took over the stewardship of the breakfast slot, with Simon Mayo slipping into his vacated drive time show. We'll come back to 5 Live in a moment, but first, here's a taster of how Chris Evans kicked it all off.
Good morning, friends, and thanks for tuning in to the 11th of January 2010, a big day because representing England, Jeff Ross from Clacton-on-Sea and his lovely wife Janet are celebrating their 47th wedding anniversary. Representing Scotland, Suzanne and Ali Murray from Edinburgh are bidding on their first property. They really hope they get it because it'll be their first cosy home and they plan to start a family. Representing Northern Ireland, Richard Napier from Belfast is doing a presentation in front of 30 people today and has been feeling nervous all weekend. I know how you feel, Rich. And representing Wales, Angela from Barry's three-year-old boy Luke starts nursery school for the first time this afternoon. Today's show is dedicated to anyone who hasn't been able to sleep recently for all the right reasons. And today's show is entitled Peace and Love and Let This Be a Force for Good.
Well, look, we've been joined for this segment by St. Albans' finest and Media Guardian radio correspondent John Plunkett. What an honour.
Great to be here.
So, look, it's been Chris Evans's first week in the Wogan hot seat. How do we think he did? How many stars are you giving him, John?
Well, for the Monday show, I give him just 2 stars. But for later in the week, I think it was rising to 3, possibly 3.5.
Right. And are you an Evans fan?
I am an Evans fan. I was looking forward to it. I was quite excited. But I think the Monday show, I don't know if he was nervous or maybe he was so keen on toning down the Evans act so as not to offend too many togs that he was in danger of disappearing altogether. And I thought it was a really underwhelming first show. But by Wednesday, Thursday, I think he really hit his stride and you could tell that he was really getting into it.
Well, Paul Robinson, no one should judge a restaurant on opening night. How many stars would you be giving Evans this week?
I think I'd agree with John and give him 3.5. And I think probably the diagnosis of John is right, but probably how else could Evans do it? Because, I mean, Wogan's been doing this job 27 years in total. You know, a whole generation have grown up with Wogan. And Evans is no question, without question, a talented broadcaster, but a different style. So if Evans had come on full throttle, you know, top gear on the first day, I think he would have sent some togs, you know, straight to the grave. So I think he was right in that sense to rev it up. I think the interesting question is going to be what happens when we see the first set of radar figures when they come out in May. You know, will the net total be higher or lower or the same as Wogan? And I think it's probably a good bet to say it's going to go down initially, but then I think actually over time, I think Evans is going to surpass Wogan's figures.
Well, Maggie, you're the nearest thing Media Talk's got to a tog.
Yeah.
How many stars would you be giving Evans?
Well, I'm afraid we all seem to I don't like consensuses, but I was thinking about three. I mean, if it's a restaurant, as you said, it's kind of palatable.
Do you think he was too loud and shouty going in?
Well, I mean, he's just so different. I mean, he is not Terry Wogan. Terry Wogan had this kind of surreal kind of ability to sort of extemporize on a theme. It was extraordinary. So he can't be the same. He has to be himself. I put it down to sort of bottled cheerfulness. I mean, he is quite a cheery personality. And then I thought it was quite clever the way, I mean, it's not rocket science, that he was photographed with his rather attractive wife and his son, Noah.
Toddler, yeah.
Well, not so attractive. The toddler was resolutely not smiling. His face was sort of turned down, rather grumpily. But, you know, like, why the hell have I been dragged out to Broadcasting House on a cold Monday morning? But I thought that that's what the BBC wants. It wants a steady figure who isn't going to go off the rails. And with the departure of Jonathan Ross, if Chris Evans plays his cards right, he is actually moving into the mainstream. We know he's an accomplished television presenter. There's a lot that he can do for the BBC if he holds his act together.
Well, this is the big question, because he's had big jobs in the past, both at Radio 1 and also commercially, and it seems to have gone off the rails or fallen apart, Paul, after a spate of, say, 4 or 5 years of great success. Does your crystal ball look that far into the future?
Well, I worked with Chris Evans at Radio 1, not when he was doing The Breakfast Show, but when he actually did Too Much Gravy, the show that was on Sunday afternoon that replaced Philip Schofield when he went off to go and do Joseph. And I think we're a very different Evans now to that Evans of 15 years ago. And I think he's had his wild time. I think he's realised that probably if he screws this one up, you know, where else are you going to go? He's got the biggest single radio gig in the UK, effectively, in popular radio anyway. And I think he's probably realised if he plays his cards right, he can do exactly as Maggie says. And he could be on The Breakfast Show on Radio 2 for 10 years. You know, you don't throw that away quickly. He's got a new wife. He's got a kid. You know, what was interesting too was, I remember at Radio 1, Evans would never do rehearsals. He would never come in and rehearse. And he was in...
He was in the week before.
Doing it for live at 7 a.m. just rehearsing. That to me was a signal that Evans has changed.
So John Plunkett, the BBC, like they do seemingly everything, promoted the hell out of this arrival. It was on News 24, that sort of TV advert they had. Was that a mistake, given that you kind of need time to grow into these slots, or do you think they did the right thing?
Well, I think cross-promotion of the BBC's radio shows on TV has been a bugbear of commercial radio for years and years, and I don't think that this particular promo is anything worse than they've done before. In fact, maybe it was... it felt like he was everywhere in terms of he did lots of appearances on The One Show and Friday Night with Jonathan Ross, and he was even on The Andrew Marr Show on Sunday morning, which was slightly unusual.
Hold the Prime Minister, we've got Chris Evans coming up.
He's standing for election this year. So I don't think the promotion was over the top, and the press, there was so much press around Terry Wogan going that I think that they couldn't afford to wait and give him a few months to bed in, so they had to go for it. I think the interesting question is, as Paul says, he could be at Radio 2 for years and years, and he could be on BBC One on Friday nights within a couple of months if he takes over from Jonathan Ross. I mean, the BBC haven't got many star faces now. They've got Graham Norton, they've got Gary Lineker, and they've got, well, Chris Evans. So I think he's possibly in one of the leading contenders, along with Norton, to maybe get the Friday Night Chat Show if he wanted it.
Well, yes, that will be an interesting scenario to see how that plays out. One star who is meant to be on the rise is Simon Mayo, whose transition from 5 Live to Radio 2. Maggie, do you think that was successful?
Well, I'm a real fan of Simon Mayo, and I have to say my honest feeling is that he's wasted on Radio 2 playing records, because I think he's a fantastic speech broadcaster. I was also very interested that they'd introduced a new segment, which is solving your homework problems. This is geared at young mums. I mean, ringing in and saying, oh, my 10-year-old son's got to learn a whole chunk of a poem and some Shakespeare, you know, by the end of the week. How do I do it? Then the Radio 2 audience coaches you and all that, which is a new thing. And that struck me as actually... The commercial critics have always said, of course, Radio 2 has been stealthily moving down the age range. Well, my eyes actually went out on stalks when I heard that. It reminded me of Chris Tarrant in the 90s, before he kind of moved totally into television, when on Capital Radio at about 9 o'clock in the morning, after you dropped your kids off at school, because I know I used to do this, I sometimes used to sit and have a coffee in my car, and he would sort of go into a sort of mumsy kind of area. And it was so like that, I was absolutely startled. But Mayo's a fantastic broadcaster.
Okay, well, look, big changes at 5 Live, Paul, with Richard Bacon, who is a friend of the podcast, et cetera, et cetera. He's gone from the graveyard slot into afternoons. And he even had David Cameron on his program.
Do you think he is quite suited to that? Because it seems to be, you know, some of these shows need a bit of time bedding down.
I thought that Mayo adapted very quickly into the Radio 2 slot. And in fact, I slightly disagree with Maggie in a sense. I think what Mayo brings is that journalistic credentials he's built up over the last few years at 5 Live, he can bring to Radio 2 with the music and almost return that show a bit like to the days of John Donne when there was good journalism in there as well as music.
Well, he was so, asking for his tattoos, sure. You know, but what I think about tattoos? That's how it just should. Seemed a bit demeaning to me.
I agree. But
you do, for the radio time, you've got Jeremy Vine with all that sort of talk, and then you've got.
Yes, but
what's his face? Who does love song dedications? Whose name I've
Steve Wright.
Yeah, Steve Wright. There's a bit of chat on that. You've got another slot with chat.
Well, I think it's very important though that Radio 2 is demonstrably a public service network, and having more speech is one way in which you can say that's not a commercial radio station. In fact, just back to Evans for a second, the one problem with the Evans show was it was not public service broadcasting. That show was a commercial show without adverts. And if I was commercial radio, I'd be actually lobbying very hard to have music on there that was not the Beatles, Whitney Houston and Bon Jovi. You can get played anywhere else. But back to Richard Bacon, I think Richard's a very intelligent broadcaster. He's an intelligent man. I think he felt slightly uncomfortable on 5 Live in the first few days. I think he will settle down. He needs strong production. I think he's got potentially a great opportunity because he's got a young audience and a young voice, and I think he can bring a freshness. But I think of the three we've talked about, he was the least easy in terms of settling into the show of the three we've talked about.
Plunkett, Gabby Logan was another new face, well, presenter, but stepping up to the plate, successfully or not.
Gabby Logan, yeah, I think she has the biggest challenge in the sense that midday to 2 p.m. is often the newsier slot in the afternoon.
You're expecting questions. Bulletin, aren't you?
That's right. There used to be a midday news there, which I still miss. Yeah, I think she was comfier doing sport than she was doing PMQs, for instance, this week. But what really struck me was looking back to when 5 Live launched as a rolling news and sports station. And when you look at the schedule now, you've got 3 hours of news breakfast, 3 hours of news drive time, but the rest is either sport or it's very much kind of magazine orientated show. So
yeah, well, news, sport, and now from we heard from that promo, and entertainment.
So it's almost setting itself up as a rival to daytime TV, I think, which is possibly a good thing. But I don't know how far that moves away from 5 Live's original remit.
Anyway, we're going to finish with a little sting from the Tony Livesey show, which I think is the first 5 Live to come from Manchester. Have a listen to this.
Within 3 weeks, we got rid of Saddam. It was a carefully targeted military campaign, so that.
But the problem is, Con, and I will bring John Tipple in on this. John, do you accept it was a brilliant campaign? But I'm sure you'll have doubts with what's happened post-war.
I don't think it was a brilliant campaign. 1 million dead.
Oh, bollocks. Sorry, excuse my French.
Con, I must apologise for Con's language.
I think we'll leave that one right there. Let us know what you think about these radio changes over on our blog, guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. I'm Stephen Brook. You're listening to Media Talk. And for those of you who like your news in brief, it's time for our NIB section. Paul, let's start with you. Well, actually, let's start with Simon Cowell and ITV. Simon Cowell reported to have turned down a $140 million offer to stay at American Idol. He's going to bring the X Factor to the US instead. Do you admire this act of philanthropy?
I think Simon knows exactly what he's doing, and that is he's going to make far more money from his production company and from owning the rights to the show than he is from appearing merely as a paid judge on someone else's show. So this is about broadening that brand and making it into a global brand. And I think if he can crack the US, he can expand that into all the other international markets. So he's going to make more money for a short-term loss.
It's interesting, Maggie, because it almost seems, and of course the X Factor USA is not going to be screening until next year, but the whisper is that ITV are going to have to revamp their entire schedule to accommodate him, and they might put the X Factor on at the start of the year, which could mean that Britain's Got Talent and Dancing on Ice appears over the summer.
Well, this is very serious, but I mean, this has been almost like an inevitable development because one knew that Simon Cowell wanted to go to America and make money by owning a format, which is he has a big slice of X Factor. But the second thing is, remember, for ITV, the crucial commercial period is actually the run up to Christmas when the advertisers really, really want to get onto the network. So this has very serious potential impacts on their earnings, but. This has been a nightmare that has been so obviously going to arrive for ITV that I'm absolutely not surprised.
And ITV's issue is ITV have got to get some new formats. The trouble is that, you know, they're reliant on Simon Cowell. They've got three or four bankable shows they roll out every year. You know, where's the successor to those? Because over time, these things will fade in the way that Big Brother is now coming to the autumn of its years. You know, what are the new big ideas that are going to propel ITV in the next 5 years? I guess that's what Archie Norman's talking about when he says a very different ITV.
But do they really need to have those ready to go now? Because surely you sort of, you're working on them, and then when the X Factor falls, the X Factor is still on an upward curve.
Look what happened to the ABC in the US when they decided when Millionaire was absolutely flying, and they stripped it 5 days a week and then 7 days a week, and they cut back development. Then, of course, what happened was Millionaire fell, and they had nothing in the cupboard to replace it. So I think very risky strategy, because you never know when these shows are going to fall off the edge of their lifetime. So I'd be putting trying to find new shows now, because you never know when you're going to need them.
Takes years to develop a successful new show. I mean, Come Dine With Me, which is absolutely like sort of polyfiller for Channel 4 at the moment. I mean, that's a daytime show that's been adapted and moved into primetime. So, no, I mean...
Well, they're making the Millionaire mistake with that, because it is on.
Of course it is, but
all the time, isn't it?
They're burning it now, because it's at the end of its life. The real problem of Simon Cowell is not so much actually that either Britain's Got Talent or X Factor won't work, because I think it will continue to work. It's all about the timing and where his focus is, and the fact that he is irreplaceable because he is this enormous star. And he's unfortunately for them, such a big star in America that ITV is now the also-ran in his priorities.
Well, another plank in the ITV strategy, Harry Hill, possibly off to join Sky. There's talk of a £3 million deal, which seems a lot of money in this day and age. More problems for them if he goes, or can Paul O'Grady fill the gap there?
Well, Paul O'Grady could fill the gap. I mean, Paul O'Grady is a classic, quintessential ITV star. Paul O'Grady, of course, was talking to Sky and didn't do the digital route, because clearly you cut your audiences, and that is the big danger with Harry Hill. Harry Hill started at Channel 4 in the 90s, and he's taken a long time to be nursed into the mainstream. We forget this. So he may well be very careful before he leaps. And, of course, there is the terrible Richard and Judy precedent behind all of this, that if you go off to a digital channel, although Watch is not the same as Sky One, you are risking oblivion.
Yes, yes. Well, another Sky story. Sky News this week, the head of that Sky, John Riley, counterattacked after Peter Mandelson had a dig at the channel and said it was taking its news agenda from the Sun. We're not normally used to Sky News being so outspoken, are we, Paul?
No, we're not. But I think John's point, which was a good one, was that actually the reason that Sky News is impartial, and I think broadly it is impartial, is not because of the ownership of Sky News, but because it actually makes good sense to be so. You know, the reason Sky News exists is not to make money. It's actually to add legitimacy to Sky and to help cement Sky into the broadcasting fabric of the UK. That's why it is impartial, and that's the key.
Yes, in contrast with Rupert Murdoch's other news channel, Fox, which causes liberals all sorts of angst over in the US. Although there was a very interesting critic who put his head above the parapet this week, Maggie Brown, Matthew Freud, who's Rupert's son-in-law.
Indeed.
That was quite extraordinary, wasn't it? Because
yes, it was.
We have never had a member of the extended Murdoch family come out and take a pop at Fox News in quite the way that Freud did. We don't really know what's all going on here, do we?
Well, I think actually it just shows that Freud is actually very much part of the British establishment, and he knows what he likes in news, and he likes the kind of more English traditional, British traditional news flow than Fox News, which, I mean, I do watch at home, and it is amusing up to a point, but the kind of... And the panel discussions, these terribly aggressive, loud panel discussions, they are amazing for a bit. It's like a sort of watching a gladiator or something, but...
All of that is true, but then why tell the New York Times that?
Yes, exactly. Great. I mean, why not? I mean, maybe it's... I mean, people have freedom of expression, you might say, another good British trait. I don't know is the answer, but I would also agree with Paul. I watch a hell of a lot of Sky News, and Sky News is not particularly biased. It can be fast and it can be wrong, and it can take more risks than the BBC, but it isn't fundamentally a partial channel.
And let's remember, Fox News is where it is because there is an audience for it in the US. I mean, you know, the US,
but
there's a huge group of people who are very right-wing in the US, and it's self-serving their own beliefs.
Yeah. Whereas here we've got lots of partial newspapers that... politically aligned people can get stuck into, such as The Independent. And the latest news emanating from there this week, as I'm sure you've all read,
is that the often brilliant but usually belligerent Sunday Times and Spectator columnist Rod Liddell is being lined up to become its next editor. The ex-Today programme editor is believed to be the favoured candidate of Alexander Lebedev, the Russian oligarch who bought the London Evening Standard 12 months ago and now wants to add The Independent to his collection. Maggie, you once, somewhat controversially, had your own car parking space when you worked at the Indie all those years ago.
I was one of the founders, and yes, that was my price for joining.
Anyway, back onto
back
Liddell.
On Liddell. Well, what
do you make of this? Because you couldn't make this up. In fact, this story was going round, and people didn't write it because they didn't believe it.
Yes. Well, all I can say is this. The Independent doesn't actually have the resources, really, to be what it wants to be, which is a national, serious newspaper. It doesn't have enough staff. It doesn't have enough in-house writers. So it's been, in a sense, turning itself into a views paper for a long time, with some still very good ideas and some good writers, but basically a views paper. Now, this is not so far away, actually, from the concept of The Economist, when you think about it, in part, because it does actually have come to you with an agenda very often. But The Indie is, as a daily paper, in a desperate place. It shows that even, Roger Alton, as the editor, only in his second year, clearly hasn't had the resources to stamp his authority on it. And when papers start talking about changes of editors and owners like this, you can see how really quite destabilised it is. So,
do you think this is going to happen? I mean, we know that Lebedev has not yet bought The Indie, but will the staff revolt and
February.
The wider public revolt?
If it's sold, I don't see that the staff have much to do with it, because it will be sold if it's going to be sold. If Lebedev, which I don't understand how, but if he intends to take it free, which is another of the factors to bear in mind here, you have to remember distribution is a very expensive thing. And you can have a paper like TVAM that is distributed in Canary Wharf or in, you know, London Bridge Station, that kind of thing, because you're targeting a group of people. But
city
people. Well, I don't know who The Independent, if it goes free, will be targeted at. But that's another question I don't know. Will Liddell make a good editor? Well, he's incredibly quirky. And remember, he deliberately turned himself from being the editor of the Today programme, which meant ghastly hours and all that goes along with that, into a very controversial and very successful and well-paid columnist.
Well, this is it, isn't it, Paul? Because the complaints about Liddell are now being made by the people who probably quite enjoyed him when he was Today editor, because when he was Today editor, he wasn't this right-wing controversialist. He was accused of being too lefty. I don't quite know where that all leaves us, but do you think he's got what it takes to be editor of The Indie or any other newspaper?
Well, I think if you look at his time at Today, you'd probably have to say he actually did a pretty good job, and I think was generally fairly well respected for what he did with Today. And there's no doubt he is a quirky and great columnist. Whether he's actually an editor of a newspaper, don't know. But, I mean, what I do know is, you know, whether you're a brilliant columnist or not, you've got to bring people with you. And the amount of bile and hate being poured out on the internet about him does make you believe that you have to question whether or not he is the guy to lead a team, particularly, as Maggie says, a small team where you've got to get every ounce out of every single person. You can't afford passengers. So, you know, I think I'd question his managerial capabilities.
Well, there was a very interesting tweet from Richard Sambrook, who was the BBC guy who hired Liddell for Today, which was, "Dear Mr. Lebedev, if you want to know what it's like to employ Rod Liddell as an editor, give me a call." Before we go, let's find out what our panellists have learnt this week. Maggie, what have you learnt this week?
Well, I was actually quite surprised, but you know Channel 4 starting a new book show on More 4, and then it's on Channel 4 lunchtime on Mondays. Well, I didn't actually realise it's completely advertising funded, and it's being funded by Specsavers. They are putting up the budget. I just spoke to the person who did the deal, and I had in my naivety assumed it was all about Amanda Ross and her wonderful ability to get books talked about, and that it was being made by Cactus, which it is being made by her independent production company, and she did make the Richard and Judy show. But I was just absolutely gobsmacked.
Books, Specsavers, quite a good fit, kind of.
Quite a good fit, yes. But
Paul Robinson, what have you learnt this week?
Well, I learned that the spirit of Greg Dyke has truly died because...
Really?
Yes.
This is big news.
Big news. Shock, horror. Sorry to bring it at the end of the show. I went to the BBC this week for a meeting and, gosh, there were plates full of croissants. I thought they'd been banned. They were very nice, though.
All right. Well, with that, it's time to vacate the studio. Thanks, of course, to Maggie Brown and Paul Robinson. You'll find links to everything that we've discussed at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk, and you can find us on Twitter and Facebook too. Matt's back next week in a special show from the Oxford Media Convention, so you wouldn't want to miss that one, would you? Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Stephen Brook, and I'm not reading the rest of that. Thanks for listening.
And what did it say?
It said, I am available day and night for interviews, comment, for a very modest fee.
Well, at least you charge for it.
Yes.